From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forteau.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is your co-host, Michelle Forteau, welcoming you to a wonderful winter wonderland up here in Willow, Alaska. We celebrated the Willow Winter Carnival yesterday, and I'd like to get into it with Robert a little bit about how did the event start off?
Well, we started off helping out our kennel partners with a sprint race. It's often interesting to see a bunch of long-distance and mid-distance sled dogs with huge sleds take part in a sprint race where some of the fastest sprint mushers in the world are here.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was a great time for our dogs. They got off to a good start. It was a good little test run for them, a fun run, if you will. We're not too serious about sprint mushing, but the dogs did have a good time. Kennel handler Austin had a great time. It was a good experience for him. And it was quite amazing to see those 12-foot heavy old sleds, long-distance sleds, have a good run in against the sprint sleds that are only like 3 feet long.
Well, it is a two-day event, so we'll be out there today in minus 28-degree temperatures. We didn't have a big spectator turnout at the carnival yesterday, but there was a lot of participants, and I sure saw a whole bunch of frosty dogs.
Absolutely. You know, there was a large turnout for the indoor event, but I was reading this morning, Fairbanks did a human fun run up in their neck of the woods at minus 50 degrees, and they had a pretty decent turnout. About six runners showed up to do that little 5K run, and they've canceled events up in Fairbanks for the wind chill factors alone for the dog events. So, you know, minus 28 does sound very chilly if you're in the lower 48. It is cold to us. I wouldn't say extremely chilly, but when you're standing out there for 3 or 4 hours on end, it can get bitterly cold.
Speaking of cold, last week we talked a lot about the cold up here in Alaska and how we deal with it. But, you know, in Anchorage, it's going to be one of the coldest Januaries on record. And a lot of people don't know this in the lower 48, but they have their kids in elementary and middle schools go out for recess during this cold. And it's just part of the curriculum. They're used to it. And they had to cancel recess a couple of days last week at some of the schools because of the wind chill. But the kids said they wanted to go outside. They were bouncing off the walls.
You know, and that's just fine, but I do know that sometimes kids show up at school without proper attire, and that is an important thing to mention up here in Alaska. You know, as parents, I'm sure we all do our best to make sure they've got on two pairs of socks and their boots as well as their base layers and their coats, but sometimes, you know, first graders like to get undressed on their way to school in the bus and they lose things. We have a special guest today. And I'm going to have Robert help us out with the introduction. This is going to be a discussion about Holocaust dogs, and it will be very interesting. I hope that our beginning part of the show captured you enough, because the next part of the show is going to be quite intriguing with Susan from Holocaust Dogs. Susan, how are you today?
Okay, and you?
It's a little chilly, but I'm okay right now with my cup of cocoa.
Good.
Good. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Susan. I didn't get your last name. I didn't get the website just yet. So what is Faithful Friends all about?
Well, about myself, I'm a certified animal behavior consultant. And I'm also, as you know, an author and search and rescue dog trainer. And I had seen a movie, The Diary of Anne Frank, and what happened was I noticed they were risking their lives to save their cat, to hide the cat with them. And I thought there would be other stories like that. And that's where I started to do the research for Faithful Friends, which is about the pets of the Holocaust survivors.
Absolutely. I think I hear some birds in the background. Are you a connoisseur of birds? You have birds that you take care of?
Oh, I have two birds, and they just decided right now to be chatty. Usually they sit there quietly, so they'll settle down in a minute.
That's just fine. My mom has birds, and I enjoy listening to them. So when you saw The Diary of Anne Frank, it inspired you to come up with stories about how the Holocaust victims were able to save their faithful friends. I'm quite interested in this because it's always amazing to me how whenever there's any sort of tragic event, whether it be a natural disaster or something unforeseen such as what these poor people had to endure, it's amazing how we will put our lives on the line for our pets.
Well, this is true, and that became very evident with the Hurricane Katrina, if you'll recall. People refused to be saved rather than leave their pets, and some people and their pets died because of that. They've since changed policies, because before the policy was you couldn't bring your pet with you if there was a rescue crew to get you off the roof of your house, for example. And you know, that's part of what my book is about, not so much that these people had a choice in saving their pets, but the human-animal bond. The book really is about the human-animal bond.
Okay. Well, when did this book get published? Was it recently?
Yes, it was just this past spring.
And how can we find this book? Is it an ebook only, or is it published in hard copy?
Oh, it's published in hard copy. It's also available on Kindle. I'm not sure if it's available on the other one. What is that called? Nook. But you can get an autographed copy from me off of my website, which is www.SBulanda.com. So you can get it a couple of different ways, and at some point, you know, because it's just recently out, at some point it'll be available in bookstores, and you certainly could order it through a bookstore.
Susan, this is Robert. Thank you for joining us this morning. I am very interested in the topic of your book as well as that human-animal bond, and I know you're a canine trainer just like ourselves, and you also work with people how to become trainers. So let's delve into that a little bit and talk about that probably most important aspect of owning a pet, which is that bond. Over the years that you've been working with dogs, and it's been since the early 60s, as your biography says, and I know you've even been involved with some Siberians from time to time, tell us about that human-animal bond. What is attractive about that to people?
Well, I think it's, you know, I'm not an expert in it, but from my years of experience, what I've observed and read, I think it's the unconditional love that animals give us. And that's why they work so well in prisons and therapy dogs, because no matter what you are or how you are or what handicap you might have, the dog, the cat, the bird, whatever it is, doesn't care. They love you unconditionally. And I think that's the essence of the human-animal bond. It's hard not to love something that loves you like that.
Absolutely, I understand. But Susan, how did your research come about? I mean, did you ever find along the way a harrowing story that you might be able to give us a little bit of a taste of your book with?
Well, some of the stories are sad, and some people have trouble reading because of that. But some of the stories are actually very happy. And one of the things that surprised me is the kindness that the certain German soldiers and Italian soldiers showed to the animals and to the people, which was pretty remarkable. Because everybody has this image of the SS, the Gestapo, the cruelty. And I'm not denying that that didn't exist, but within individuals, there was kindness, understanding, and really people that didn't want to do this and didn't want to be there. And that came out in one story in particular. And that story was about a woman who was part of the French underground. And she, and I'm just going to give a brief synopsis of it because it's a rather detailed story, but she was captured and sent to the camps. And when she was in jail before she was sent away, she got a German soldier to promise her to take care of her dog, because when they captured her, she was in the garden with her dog. She had to just drop the dog and go. So she was really worried what would happen to her dog. And he did. He went back and he got the dog and took care of it. And her account is about what happened and how she was eventually reunited with the dog. So there's an example that was pretty remarkable, I think.
Absolutely, Susan. You know, we've interviewed a few other people that helped Katrina, Hurricane Katrina aftermath, with pets that were not able to be reunited with their families. And I'm very thankful that the rules have changed as far as how you rescue a person with their pet. Do you have any advice for listeners out there as far as, you know, what do you do in those situations where it's you or the pet?
Hello?
Can you hear us, Susan?
Yeah, we got cut off for a minute.
That happens sometimes on internet radio, so we apologize. If it does drop, just make sure you call right back in. But
okay.
You're still on with us. So, Michelle, did you get Michelle's question or no?
Yes, I did. What to do? Well, first of all, if you go to my website, I've written articles about just that, how to prepare for a disaster, what to do in the case of a disaster. You'd have to hit the tab for Examiner, and the articles are on an Examiner site, but I do cover that from a search and rescue point of view. The best thing you could do for any type of disaster, and let's keep in mind, we never know when disasters are going to strike. You don't know when you're going to get that blizzard, that ice storm, the flood, a tornado, hurricane, or earthquake, or whatever. But you have to have a disaster kit for yourself and for your pet, something that you can just grab on a moment's notice. And then go to wherever you have to go for the type of disaster it is and for your location. And you should know that ahead of time. And have that ready. And that's the best ounce of prevention that you could do, because you can't control the weather.
So let's go back to Faithful Friends for just a second, Susan, and let's talk about those stories. And I know you had mentioned to me in email as well as in your biography about the cover of the book, that most of these stories come from the children of the Holocaust. How do you think that that affected the relationship that they had with their pets? Everybody knows that every child has their favorite friend, whether it be, like you said, a cat, dog, bird, whatever. So how do you think that that was detrimental to them during the Holocaust?
Well, I think if we think back to when we were children, and those of us that have raised kids or worked with kids, I don't think children have the full grasp of a situation like that. They know that they can sense the danger, they can sense the understanding of, you know, of what their parents are going through, but they don't have the life experience to really know what the danger and the fear is all about. So I think in that sense they turn to their pets and bond with them even more. A couple of times people that related their stories to me, told me they would hold their pets at night for comfort, or they would talk to their pets to tell them all their fears. And you know, it's I think that because of the lack of awareness of the political situation, of understanding of war in particular, they didn't grasp the gravity of what was happening, but they had the fear. I don't know if I'm making myself clear on that, but you know, you have to look at it from a child's world, and because of this, they couldn't understand why they couldn't bring their pets with them.
You know, you mentioned, Susan, about the Holocaust, and how it took place. And, of course, everybody knows about the German concentration camps and things like that. But you mentioned the Italians. Can you give us some examples, you know, not being too graphic or anything, but maybe aside from what we've always learned in the history books and in school and things, about how these people had to survive over time in these different types of environments?
Well, one person in particular, I'm trying to remember which story it was now, but it's in my book. And what happened is an Italian commander was in charge of a certain group of Jewish people that were captive. And he took them out of their homeland and brought them to an island, and I just don't remember the name of the island, but he was instrumental in keeping those people safe, keeping them fed, keeping them healthy. And then when the war was over, he actually, in the case of the woman that told me her story, he actually brought them to out of that island and helped them immigrate to wherever they wanted to or get back home. And I thought that was pretty remarkable because you never read about that, or never hear about that in all of the accounts of World War II. So that's one example.
A great example of the human condition is just because you're in a situation that is dire doesn't necessarily mean that even your captors are the ones that are the bad guys all the time. They're human too. They may have standing orders or whatever because they're in the military, but they often see the human side of it as well, don't they?
Yes. As a matter of fact, if you read through history, you'll see that in the case of World War II and Germany, many of the people, if they didn't serve and go in the military and do what they were told, they were in fear that their families would be killed back home. And that's not just only in Germany. That happened in other countries. So you have to realize a lot of these people did it as a means of self-preservation. It didn't mean they had an evil heart. So,
and in most countries besides the U.S., and again, not to downplay the Holocaust at all, but military service is required for all men to be involved in the military before they go to college or whatever. It's a requirement of their country, unlike the U.S., right?
That's correct. I don't know every country today, but I do know that there are a couple that do require that.
Right. So, in your book, Faithful Friends, how many stories are involved? Are these recounts from survivors? Are they taken from third hand accounts? Where did you get your information from?
Well, there's I think seven countries that I cover, and you know, a couple of countries have more than one story. So there are about 10 or 12 accounts. Most of the accounts that I got were firsthand. These were the people, the children that survived, and I managed to track them down, and it took me quite a few years to do that. And I managed to track them down, and they were willing to share their stories with me. One or two accounts were one account was from a journal that a woman kept, and her relatives gave that to me because she had passed on. And another one was a combination of journal and first-hand accounts. But one story I think was a second-hand account. But most of them were first-hand. I actually talked to the people and interviewed them. So, and it took me years and years to track them down because I should have done this 30 years ago.
Well, no time like the present, so I do applaud you for your efforts. And, you know, I've been toying around with book ideas for a long time. And as people have always told me, you just got to sit down and do it. And then once you get started, it flows pretty nicely. So when you spoke to these guys on the phone or via email or letter or whatever, what was their response now 60, 70 years later? How do they still remember that all this time later?
Well, because it was a traumatic event in their life, it's hard to forget. there were some details, you know, like daily living type details that they didn't always remember that I had would like to have included. But for the most part, everybody that I spoke to thanked me for caring enough to ask and for giving them closure. You have to remember that, and people forget, in those days, the main source of information was a radio or word of mouth or an outdated newspaper. Even when I was young, I can remember going to the movies and seeing newsreels because that was the way you learned about events in the world. Today, people forget you didn't have the communication system you have today. No internet, no computer, no telephones, no television. So information was difficult to get, and therefore a lot of the people, and you know, because today people say, well, how come they didn't know? Why didn't they leave? First of all, some people didn't believe it. They just couldn't imagine that something like this could happen. And they didn't have all the information. So the kids back then, you know, there was so much turmoil and tension as bits of information would come in and adults would get nervous and they would try to decide what to do. In some cases, they moved to another area where they felt would be safer. You know, there was a lot going on, and it's hard to forget that. These people pretty much remembered everything they had that went on.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, I was just going to mention that, you know, I think that it's almost sad in the aspect of what you just described, that we have an entire generation that cannot fathom, let alone imagine, what kind of terror these people went through. I mean, communication is not just via the internet and telephone now. It's instantaneous.
Right.
And it happens the moment it happened. So there's virtually no history is what I'm trying to say. I mean, that moment in time that just happened is heard around the world within 10 seconds of it occurring. So, I mean, that in itself is unimaginable, you know, even to Robert and I's generation. We kind of grew up on the outside of the internet cusp. It kind of happened in our teenage lifetime. And my children... you know, they're learning about the Holocaust now in high school, and it appalls them as to what happened, but they really can't grasp why this occurred. Why did the world allow this to happen? And when you try to explain to them that the world didn't know that it was happening for months, years, until it was brought to the attention of the world, it was already too far gone for so many. They just cannot grasp that. So for the pets, I can only imagine what those children and those adults were thinking. You know, oh my gosh, we've got to get these pets out of here. Well, not only that, we've got to get our children safe. I mean, what do you do? There was no one there to help for such a long time because the news just couldn't get out.
Well, not only that, but you have to realize, too, that when the full realization of what was going on, when they saw neighbors and people taken away and communities moved into the ghettos and this kind of stuff, the last thing they wanted to hear about was the pet in many cases. And I'm not saying they didn't love their pets, but, you know, if after it was all said and done, you get a child who maybe is now 10 or 12 or even 15, 16 years old, mourning the loss of a pet when one of their parents or their siblings or their grandparents have all been killed. You know, it's just like they didn't get the closure and the sympathy for the loss of the pet because of all the human deaths that occurred. And that's why they were grateful to me for writing this book.
Yeah, that's a great point, and we've had several guests on that talked about the grief process, not only with our human companions and how difficult that is, but also the closure that a lot of us must have, especially today, with the passing of our pets. And I think that that's an important part of the human emotion, is to be able to do that, even whether it be in the 1940s or 2012. I think that's an important part. So, Susan, my next question is, the response from your readers. I haven't had a chance to read your book. You and I connected on LinkedIn. But what has been the response from some of the readers from reading your book? How have they taken this part of history? And, you know, you told a story that hasn't been told before. How are they understanding from what you've got?
Well, most people some people can't read the book. They find it, you know, some of the animals die. They all eventually die, as you know. But some of the animals don't make it, and they find that hard to read about. But it's part of what happened. And most people are just really grateful that I did this book, that I put this piece of history down. I've had people email me that are pet writers saying, I never even thought of that. I never even occurred to me to write about that. And so far, nobody's come up to say, oh, I wrote about that. There's been little stories here and there that have been published sporadically over the years, but never an in-depth look at this particular aspect of the Holocaust. And I'm a big history buff. I like research, obviously. But I think this is part of the picture that needs to be told. I think that there's an important lesson for people here. And it's just sad that it took a recent hurricane to change the rescue rules on rescuing people with pets. I mean, it seems to me that if they had read a book like my book earlier, maybe they would have done something sooner.
Totally agree there. We're talking to Susan Belanda. She is the author of Faithful Friends. It's a collection of firsthand stories about the pets of the Holocaust. Susan, if we can switch gears just a little bit and talk about your work with training people to become trainers. Michelle and I have done that for years at our training schools. Can we get some insight about your philosophy in terms of training of dogs? Since this is a dog training show, let's talk a little bit about dog training. What I know, you're a big search and rescue advocate, and you worked in that field for a long time. But what do you teach your students about the world of dog training? Of course, in today's age, again, with information technology flowing like crazy, a lot of our clients want the fad of the day, whether it be on television or something they read on the internet or something that their friend is doing down the street. How do you approach new clients or new students in regards to training dogs?
Well, first of all, I have two programs I developed at Kutztown University. Level one is for students that want to learn to be a dog trainer, and level two is for students that want to start their certification process to be a dog or cat behavior consultant. And basically, I'm a senior citizen, as you know, and I was in dog training. I actually had a business established by the time I got into high school. So that's why I've had so many years in the field. So I've watched the training methods evolve from shock collars and jerk and hurt and coercion. Actually, in the, trying to remember now, late 60s, early 70s, I saw at an obedience trial, I'll never forget this, it was a turning point in my life, I saw a man calling his German Shepherd on a recall in a basic obedience competition. And the dog was sitting there nicely, and he yelled out the command, come. And the dog's ears went down, his head went down, his tail went down, and he just basically crouched his way over to the owner. And I looked at that, and I said, you know, that's not right. And from that point on, I said, when I work with dogs and I train them, they're going to come with their heads up and their tails wagging. So then came the question of how do you accomplish that? And I believed at that point, and I still maintain this point, that the way to train a dog is through psychology and not through coercion. So when I have my programs at the university, I teach my students as much about the minds of animals, and I don't limit it to dogs. I teach them about birds and cats and horses and whatever scientific articles I can find, that they can have an understanding of the intelligence level and the comprehension level of a dog, because that is going to influence how you teach them. And remember, way back when, well, you're probably too young to remember, but everybody, scientists all said it was all instinct, that whatever, it was stimulus response, and animals couldn't think, and dogs couldn't think, and everything they did was based on instinct. I said, well, I just don't agree with that. And that's what launched me into developing and working in ways of teaching in the true sense of teaching dogs, instead of coercing, pushing, bullying, or whatever you want to call it.
So, Susan, do you recall Barbara Woodhouse?
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of the Cesar Millan of the 60s, I guess. She was the one that was on CBS 60 Minutes and that sort of thing, and giving her approach to dog training. A lot of people were attracted to that. I'm a little too young to recall the TV, of course, but I do remember reading about her in my studies. And then we went from Barbara to Karen Pryor, then now we're kind of in the Cesar Millan and what is the lady's name, the British lady? What's her name, Michelle?
I'm not sure.
What is her name? Do you know, Susan, the lady that's on television?
Victoria. No, I don't remember.
Victoria Stilwell, the positive reinforcement trainer that's on Animal Planet, Victoria Stilwell. But my question to you is, as canine training has evolved, even from the 60s, going from Woodhouse to Pryor to Cesar Millan to Victoria Stilwell and through on, how do you think that it has changed today from how it was back when you were showing dogs and things like that, several decades ago?
Well, first of all, like I said, in those days, scientists, and I can show you writings from the mid-40s from one of the top trainers from New England, who says point blank in his book, dogs don't think. So we've come from that point to the now, where people are beginning to accept the fact that dogs can think. And I think it has not been a steady progression up. Some of the people that you mentioned have had good intentions and were at the beginning of the let's teach them and show them and give them credit for thinking. And then we backslid with some of the names that you mentioned into the old jerk and hurt, bully, I'm top dog and I'm going to beat you up if you don't listen to me mentality. And there's still a lot of those kinds around, because like I teach my students, everything works some of the time and nothing works all of the time. So even the bad methods that are not conducive to the dog's mental well-being will work. They will work some of the time, and that's why those people continue to use those methods. But I can tell you in search and rescue, and I have over 20 years in the field managing search and rescue units and working with teams actually all over the world. And I can tell you, when I see a dog in a situation that you can't possibly train him for, which happens in search and rescue all the time, and that dog works out what he has to do and accomplishes the job he has to do, it's amazing the cognitive ability that dogs have. And I think that people who try to micromanage their pets, their dogs, and I'm talking now in the higher training levels, they try to micromanage their dog and tell the dog how to do his job. They limit the dog in his ability to work.
I totally agree with that, and being a musher for all these years, I use that approach to my training with clients, is you have to let the dogs work. You have to let them, you know, figure out things on their own sometimes. Of course, dogs like people are going to make bad decisions and get themselves into trouble from time to time, whether it's getting in the trash or making a G instead of a haw out on the sled dog trail. They will get themselves into trouble, and that's what training is all about, is being able to teach. That's my example of training, is to teach.
That's right.
I think that's what we're doing to our clients. How have your students taken a part with your types of training? You know, everybody has their idea going into a training school of what they want to do as trainers, whether it be the clicker method or the old yank and crank, like you mentioned, or something in between, whether it be touch-free, which is very popular today, and, you know, all these sorts of different training styles that people have. What are some of your students' initial reservations about your style compared to what they've understood from their readings or their research?
Well, first of all, I don't teach them my style. I teach them in my program, I have one course that's called Training Methodologies, and we go over all the training methods that trainers use. And I do that because even the bad ones, the ones that are the jerk and hurt and the e-collar users and things like that, they have to understand what's happened to a client's dog that may have been through that kind of training and then comes to them with problems. They have to know where it came from. They have to know the dynamics of that type of training method. And I tell my students that it's, you know, everybody came up with an idea because of some inspiration, and don't limit yourself to any one person's method. If you can come up with something better, do it. So I'm an eclectic in that sense. As long as it doesn't physically hurt and it doesn't do harm mentally to a dog, then that's how we learn to apply clicker training, which was actually used for marine animals, to dogs and cats and birds. I clicker train my birds. And you can clicker train anything, but it doesn't work on husbands and wives too well, I'll tell you that.
Whistling does sometimes.
Sometimes.
So
I actually have a sheep herding whistle I use to call my husband.
Does he come running?
Well, you know, he's always in his shop, in his wood shop, and if I don't blow the whistle, he can't hear me yelling.
Well, you know, back in the old West, they used those chimes. You know, the dinner's on the table, so it's very similar.
Oh yeah, the triangle. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have one more question in regards to dog training, and I'm glad we spent some time with this, because your insight is very similar to how I work with my students in our training courses. We do very similar things where we give them the history of dog training and the goods and the bads of each style. So in 2012, here we are, you know, being involved in formal training for well over 100 years now. Where do you see it going in the next, what's the next progression to this, do you think? You know, you've been doing this a long time. I've been doing this a long time, and I'm only 40. But what do you see, you know, tomorrow in terms of dog training?
I don't know if I think it's going to happen, but what I think should happen, what I'd like to see happen, really, what is the problem in training a dog? What is the essence of the problem? What is the essence of the goal? And that is to communicate to the dog. Communication is the breakdown. That's the part that fails. And if we can come up with a system to communicate to dogs and cats and other animals in some way, and clicker training is the first step in that. It's really a communication system that the animals can understand and they like it. And if we can come up with a way to communicate with animals, the training is going to go through the roof, because they can do anything that they physically are capable of doing. I'm not saying a dog can pick up a pen and write, but they have the capability mentally of doing anything we ask them to do. And I've proven that in search and rescue time and again by actually pioneering some techniques and philosophies that people previously said couldn't be done. And I started, actually, I'm going to backstep a minute. I actually started that with my Huskies when I had my Siberians, because they said, number one, you can't obedience train a Siberian, and you cannot train them to show in the ring and compete in obedience because they'll get confused. And I said, that is a lot of baloney. And my Siberians competed in the ring. They competed in obedience, and they raced. They did all three, and they never got confused about when to do what.
So, and that breed has come a long way, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. When I was a trainer, and back in the 60s, we're talking now, other trainers, if they had, because Siberians were rare back then, very few people had them, at least here on the East Coast. And if they got a client with a Siberian, they wouldn't even take them in their classes. They'd send them to me, because I was the only one that could successfully train them. And I understood them. I understood them because I was studying dog behavior instead of just training techniques. But the future, the real progress has to come when we find a way to communicate to the dogs what we want. Because right now, all we could do is show them. We can't tell them. And you can only show things to a limited degree. You cannot explain why you have to do this instead of that to a dog. If we can ever get to the point where we can even partially explain the why, training's going to go through the roof. Dogs will be able to do phenomenal things.
I totally agree, and, you know, with Michelle and I, we've worked for years with service dogs, and we've done a little bit of search and rescue work. That was actually my first business in the early 90s, was beginning in the search and rescue training. So working with dogs is a heck of a lot different than having dogs as pets, but it's a different mindset, I guess, in terms of how we interact with our dogs. So Michelle has one final question for you, Susan.
Sure.
Well, it's not really a question, but Susan, I think Robert and I are both agree when we come to the conclusion that it's not about training the dog at all. It's always come back to training the owners and changing how they approach their own pet that they love so much has been the key in our approach to training. You know, that's just what I've got to say about it, is that I think that that's the key. Once we get the people that understand that dogs and cats and our pets are not our toddlers, and we can't approach them in the same fashion. You know, we either have too much expectation or not enough. And it's a constant roller coaster with a dog emotionally as well as figuratively as what we think that they can and cannot do. But when we stop and notice those little things that they do without us nudging them or baiting them with treats and so on and so forth, that's when the training is truly spectacular.
I agree with you there, and you have to keep in mind that in, I think, more cases today than when I was younger, people have pets as surrogate children.
Absolutely. That's my whole point.
It
not only has the world changed since Robert and I were children in the early 70s, but the way people treat their animals is completely different. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with having your pet as a surrogate child, as long as you understand that they're not going to sit in their high chair and eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for you.
Well, not only that, but they don't let them be what they are. They don't let the dog be a dog. And that messes the dog's head up, and people don't realize it really messes their head up, because they lose some of their identity, I think. But more importantly is what people don't understand is that the dog interprets what you do, and dog rules, not people rules. And I'll give you the classic example of that. You know that, especially you guys working with Huskies would see this. When a mother comes back to the litter, the first thing the pups do is kiss her face. They run up and they lick her around the mouth and around the face, because that is instinctively how they trigger regurgitation, which is the way that in the wild they would feed them when they're real little and they have their baby teeth. It's also a sign of submission. So what happens is this little puppy who's been kind of kept in line by mom goes home, and what do people do? They pick him up and they kiss him in the face. And this little puppy says, sits back and he thinks about this and he says, wow, I didn't have to lift a paw and I'm king of the hill and they're all submitting to me. And it totally sets the relationship off on the wrong foot. Because people do that because they want to show affection, but that's not how dogs show affection.
That's exactly right. Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah, and so these are the that's just a little example of how the relationship between dogs and people gets confused. It doesn't mean you can't kiss your dog, but you've got to establish the relationship first, and you don't take this little puppy who's only had 8 or 10 or 12 weeks on the face of the earth and only adult brainwaves since they're 7 weeks old and throw something like that at them and expect them to understand it in human terms. They don't even know what people are other than they come and pet me and feed me.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Susan, we're streaming live right now on the internet, and people will hear this part of the show when they download it in the future. But I want to make sure that we give all of your contact information to our listeners. You're the author of Faithful Friends, which is a collection of firsthand accounts about pets and the Holocaust. Where can people find out more information about that?
Well, go to my website. I'm actually the author of about 6 other books, too. And if they go to my website, which is www.sbulanda, that's sbulanda.com, they can, on the home page, there's a tab on the top that says books. All my books are there. They can order an autographed copy from me, or if they don't want to do that, they can get them on Amazon or Kindle or wherever.
Sounds great. And in our second segment, we talked about what the future is of dog training, at least from Susan's point of view, and I think that's a very interesting topic that a lot of people will want to listen to. So, Susan, I do appreciate your time this morning. I know it took a couple of weeks to get connected, but it has been a great show, and I do want to thank you very much for being on with us.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
No problem. We'll make sure we send over any comments or questions that we get, and they could be any time. This show airs pretty much forever on the internet, so if we might get a comment a year from now. I'll make sure I shoot it over to you.
That's great.
I do get it.
That's great. You've got my email.
Thank you very much. So that was Susan Bulanda, the author of Faithful Friends, as well as a world-class dog trainer, been involved with dogs for a long time, including our beloved Siberian Huskies, also search and rescue work. So on behalf of our guest, Susan Bulanda, and our co-host, Michelle Forteau, this is Robert Forteau. We're getting ready to head over to the sprint races. Never forget your dreams. Goodbye.